The hour of 1 o'clock has arrived. I'll call a meeting of the Ag Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. Welcome, everybody. We have three items on today's agenda, but before we go any further, see a special friend back in the audience, a mentor of mine, Representative Rod Hamilton. Rod, welcome to the committee. Rod chaired this committee on numerous occasions. Great guy, great supporter of agriculture, and welcome to the committee, Rod. On today's agenda, we're going to be hearing from AURI, from the Deed Office of Broadband Development, and also from the Center of Rural Policy and Development. So thanks for being here. First thing is that we have some bookkeeping with the minutes from last our first meeting. Representative Nelson, have you had a chance to check over those minutes and give me your approval?
Yes, I have, and I would move their adoption.
Nelson moves to approve the minutes of the meeting. Any all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. First off today, the presentation from Agricultural Utilization and Research Institute. We have three gentlemen there to lead us off. Whoever's going to start, Shannon, probably identify yourself and to proceed for the record. Or Mr. Sparks.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dan Sparks, Director of Government and Industry Relations at AURI. We are excited to be here before you today to give you an update from AURI's perspective. We would certainly like to take this opportunity to thank you for the long-term partnership with the Minnesota Legislature to support the state's value-added agriculture sector. We look forward to the discussion today, and we'll obviously stand around to answer any questions that you may have as we move through the process. But with that, being mindful of the committee's time and yours, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I'm pleased that we have today Federico Tripodi, AURI's current board chair, and Shannon Schlecht, AURI's executive director, with me today to provide an overview of our fiscal year 2024 activities and impacts. So with your permission, Mr. Anderson, or Chair Anderson, I'd like to turn it over to Federico.
Thanks, Mr. Sparks. Just, again, a bookkeeping item. We have enough members here, so a quorum is present, so we'll proceed on with the meeting to our next testifier. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Federico Tripodi, Chairman of the Board at AURI. Thanks for inviting AURI today to share what we're doing to contribute to the Minnesota agricultural economy. Over the last 2 years, the board and staff have refreshed our mission and vision statements, and AURI is focused on helping accelerate the expansion of the agricultural economy, as we believe it's a key growth engine for our state and provides significant sources of jobs, private capital investment, and sales. Our specific way of contributing to this goal is by supporting all value-added agriculture through expanded uses and markets for any agriculturally derived product. This includes crops, livestock, value-added processing byproducts, food, and other ingredients. Our North Star is to drive impact, tangible results through the work we do, $500 million in economic impact through jobs, investment, and sales growth by the end of our fiscal year 2026, off of your roughly $4.4 million in support each year, for which we're very thankful. With over 30 years contributing to our state, our mission is even more important today as we look into the future, with critical needs to support a thriving agricultural economy, promote local production that can substitute imports, and advance efforts to create new uses and markets for our state's commodities amid an ever-changing global landscape. I do have to clarify that our board member directors that are on the list are as last fiscal year. We recently had John Schaefer retired as he termed out after 9 years of service, and Ken Heiss recently joined our board. As we also look forward to welcoming a director from this committee to our 2025 board. Directors are volunteers that represent different state organizations from all corners of Minnesota and sectors of our agricultural value chains. Our directors are highly engaged and driven by making a positive impact for Minnesotans and being good stewards of the state's resources. I want to thank Representative Vang for your service as a director to ERURI over the last several years, your commitment and support to our organization. As per statute, we have two directors from general farm organizations, three research and promotion council representatives, two agribusiness, two at-large directors, and two legislators. We meet at least five times per year, and our focus is on being good stewards of the financial resources of the organization and helping support the strategy. Again, per statute, we are required to establish and maintain facilities across Minnesota to support Minnesota agriculture. Today, we have four sites in Minnesota: Crookston, where we mainly have administrative personnel; Marshall, where we have an analytical laboratory, a mid-lab presence, a bioindustrial analytical capabilities; St. Paul, we have an office at the Food Science Department; and our new addition or expansion, our Bioindustrial Innovation Center that was opened in 2024 in Waseca, where we also do some food processing materials. We also have employees scattered across the state to support Minnesota entities and businesses. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to hand over to Shannon Schleck, our executive director, who will talk more about programs and activities.
Welcome, Mr. Schleck. Identify yourself and proceed.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Schleck. I'm the executive director at AURI. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about our activities over the last fiscal year and to share some of the impacts that we're having across the state for value-added agriculture. We take a pretty simple approach in terms of the programs that we operate to drive new opportunities. Commercialization services is really our focus in terms of our help with small businesses, medium-sized businesses, entrepreneurs, and producers to be a scientific resource for them and a business resource to look at how can we do product development, process improvements, connect their ideas into the marketplace, and then drive economic activity. I think we bring a blended approach in that manner, where we have our scientists as well as our business staff look at viable business models and then fine-tune and perfect in terms of bringing those products forward. It's always great, I think, and energizing to our staff to see products in the marketplace and know that we had a small hand in moving that forward. We also do public research initiatives where we visit with stakeholders and several agricultural organizations across the state, look for needs and gaps and where there's common information needs, and then do an applied research initiative to put that into the public space in terms of how can we fill that information as well as help drive some new opportunities that we see emerging in the value-added area. And then ARI Connects is really about just making sure that what we do doesn't sit on a shelf. It is getting it out into the industry through webinars, through events that we host around the state, through two major activities that we have that we do once a year around renewable energy and new uses, and then just an ongoing platform of different webinars that we host regularly as well. So just to look back at the year, we were pretty busy again in the past year. We opened and closed roughly 100 projects with entities across the state. Some of those were initiatives that were broad. Others were very specific in different districts, right, and with businesses in each of your districts that we worked with. We had 200 projects that we worked on overall because not all of them are, you know, fit nicely into one year. And then we also had several ARI Connects programs that I was just mentioning, where we reached over about 1,000 people in terms of participants at events and about 1,000 views afterwards. So really working hard to get that information out. And those activities all lead to the impact that we're really driving for as an organization. And you can see last year, and this one isn't on your slide, I added it to the presentation. We helped drive last year $187 million in new annual sales for Minnesota companies. Through the work that we provided and that they attributed to ARI with the role that we had. We helped drive 717 jobs that were created or retained that we supported in Minnesota. And then we helped de-risk, I would call it, $85 million in new investment that businesses made to drive new products and new processes. So we do that again with your base funding to help really put those ideas into the commercial marketplace. Our two main buckets of work that we follow for the state in value-added agriculture, one is food. We have a very robust food entrepreneurial ecosystem here within Minnesota. We have two food scientists, one meat scientist, a food business development director, and an analytical lab that supports a lot of our food entrepreneurs and our food businesses in terms of questions that they have and needs that they have to move those ideas into the marketplace. Everything from shelf life in terms of providing a food safe product and a quality product, to nutrition facts panels for the packaging requirements, to recipe scale-up formulations as they look at growing from a commercial kitchen to co-manufacturing, and then everything to look at viable business models as well in terms of are they unique or how do we look at their value proposition in terms of how they're putting themselves into the marketplace. Some recent more work that we've been doing is looking at school lunch programs and helping food businesses, local food businesses, get into their school lunch programs as well, and just helping provide that guidance and some of the regulatory requirements that they may have. One of the major projects we've had the last several years has been around local and regional meat processing. We had a partnership with USDA Ag Marketing Service to drive forward some gaps that we had seen in terms of being more resilient for that sector. That looked at everything from co-product utilization in terms of some of the waste streams to cold storage needs to looking at how do they rank against their peers, of looking at benchmarking tools, and then how can they be more bankable when they look for financing, and what does the finance community look for when they're supporting small meat processors. We had several initiatives as well that were more forward-looking and using some of the one-time money that was awarded last year to support food entrepreneurs, thinking about what is the need for scale-up manufacturing. How do you go from a commercial kitchen to co-manufacturing when a lot of co-mans have very large minimum order quantities? Is there a business model that works for in-between processing that we could help move forward? And then we see just regularly that food entrepreneurs need help on food safety. And what tools can we create and how can we better assist them in terms of meeting their food safety goals and making sure that their products are safe onto the marketplace. And then finally, one of the last projects that we did that I'll mention is AVA, is what we call it, as ARI's virtual assistant, and looking at artificial intelligence and taking curated information that we feel is very credible and putting that into a folder where the AI tool learns, and then people can query that 24/7, and it just makes us more efficient in terms of meeting some of those basic needs that our food entrepreneurial community has. And we do this not just by ourselves, right? This is a large collaboration with several entities around the state. Just a few examples. Lightfield Barbecue Sauce was a company we worked with out of the Lakeville area, Farmington area. And we helped them with recipe formulation scale-up and just looking at their business growth needs. Cannonbells is out of Cannon Falls, and we worked with them on nutrition facts panels across their product line and getting into the school lunch program. And then I mentioned AVA and the meat science work previously. Bioindustrials is the other large bucket that we work in. And this is what I consider our dirty lab, right, in terms of how we work with biomass to really look at what I call a lot of the Ds, right, the densification, the dewatering, the drying, the decortication. What are ways that we can make those products into more valuable feedstocks into different uses overall? So we do everything from product analysis to characterization to pelleting formulations for different streams that come to us that businesses are either looking to make more circular approaches around or looking at waste streams in terms of adding another value to their business. We do have a hemp decorticator. We've been doing a lot of anaerobic digestion in our bioindustrial space as well. And then just really looking at, how can we think about co-product valorization with our views in terms of what the market needs. And just a couple of examples here. One that was really interesting in the upper right-hand corner was our project with MDA and MnDOT of looking at how can we use industrial hemp fibers into erosion control products for road construction. So you think that's often jute or plastic that's used to keep sediment in place, and how can we use a new agricultural feedstock into supporting their needs of moving that forward. So we did a demonstration out in the Albertville area looking at how it worked against their standards, working with several Minnesota companies that are active in that space. Was a really interesting project for us. Another one was working with a local company to see how much soybean meal could we put into a fertilizer product to replace synthetic nitrogen, and think about the different uses where that could apply as we look at new crushing capacity and that nitrogen, right, protein that exists in soybean meal. How could we put that into lawn, ornamental, golf courses, just higher value opportunities where soybean meal could be a new raw material into those products. And then we've had several anaerobic digestion projects where we've been looking at different feedstocks and how do we think about co-digestion and just that economic opportunity that may exist for our waste streams. With your support of one-time funding, we were able to upgrade a lot of our materials and equipment for ARI. Over the past 2 years, we added elemental analyzers looking at the ability to better identify carbon and nitrogen, hydrogen and phosphorus and different materials that are coming through to see what the values are. We've added mass spectroscopy as well, which allows us to really look more deeply at different compounds in terms of flavor compounds, anti-nutrients and feed, phytochemicals and those types of activities that could really add value to some food products that and feed products that entrepreneurs are looking to bring to the marketplace. We've done a lot of upgrades to our anaerobic digestion capabilities in terms of automating and looking at what the potential is there to create renewable natural gas for different waste streams that industries have. And then we also use the one-time funds to make a move. We had been 30-plus years in Waseca and in the same location. We had run out of space, and we were able to move into a new bioindustrial innovation center, still in Waseca, just a mile down the road, but it roughly tripled our floor space that we had available. So we've become much more efficient. We've added new capabilities there as well. And we were able to expand our FDA-certified food lab to work on several projects related to grinding and oilseed pressing. So just a lot of efficiencies gained. And it now allows us to bring in equipment from our entrepreneurs as well and put that on the floor and work with them in terms of, providing guidance and insight there too. So a great add for us and really appreciate the support that we received to move that forward after decades of being in the same location. Just quickly, a couple of testimonials here. Stable Feed is a small company out of Kasson, Minnesota that we've worked with. And just their comment here, ARI services were critical to my success. ARI is a partner no entrepreneur in the ag sector should be without. They were a really interesting group of looking at equine supplements and equine feed. And we worked with them on all sorts of different ingredients they had to create a pellet that they could then put into the commercial marketplace. B&T Meats is a new small and local regional meat processing facility up in Waubun, Minnesota. And we worked with them very closely on just what they needed to be thinking about their HACCP planning, their business plan of getting that business up and running over the past year. So just again shows a little bit of the range of activities that we cover with companies around the state. I'd already mentioned several of our events, so I'm just going to pass through these, but New Uses Forum is something, our signature event every year. Last year was on bioindustrials and looking at how do we look at our feedstocks into new bioindustrial opportunities, renewable chemicals, right, renewable energy, just a lot of different opportunities there. Fields of Innovation, Webinar Wednesday are just ongoing events that we do each year. Our next one is February 20th, I believe, for Fields of Innovation, looking at how do we fail forward and just learn from our mistakes to take new ideas forward. Next Webinar Wednesday will be on protein sustainability and what's happening within the state around protein and innovation. And then renewable energy, our last one that we did in fiscal year 24 was on hydrogen's opportunities in the agricultural sector. So just thinking about how do we think about hydrogen as an asset as we look at agriculture going forward. Finally, I'll just mention, as we look forward for ARI, five areas that we're really thinking a lot about from a priority in terms of resourcing. Scaling up food manufacturing that I mentioned previously, just like how do we look at the assets that are needed or the awareness of where to go to scale up food entrepreneurial ideas that are seeing success within the marketplace here. Food ingredients, just new crops that are coming together, just what are some of the trends? Health and wellness, how do we look at working with entities around different food ingredient applications? Bioindustrials, pretty straightforward on what we're doing there. Core product valorization, again, how do we think about circular approaches and waste streams back into the marketplace? And then renewable natural gas and anaerobic digestion. Those are five areas that we're focusing on, but we also continue to work across all you know, all needs and requests that we receive to help move those ideas forward. And we've got a lot of initiatives underway, as well as, again, just showing on the slide how your one-time funding has really helped us advance and catalyze a lot of that work here over the last year. Finally, I'll just show that we're, you know, we are a broad organization in terms of our footprint. The work that we cover, we're 35 people with a broad skill set of different applications that we bring to the marketplace. Again, I think we're really unique in that technical and business sense, and I don't know of any other state that has a network where we're out having conversations with hundreds of businesses every year around Minnesota and helping connect the dots in terms of what are their problems, what are the solutions. Maybe there's a joint business relationship that we can help forge and move forward and really help drive some of this commercial activity. It's always amazing to me to have the conversations within our organization around, you know, what they're seeing, what they're hearing, and how do we connect the dots to help really drive some innovation forward. So with that, I just want to say thank you again for the long-term partnership. We really appreciate the work that we've been able to do to advance value-added agriculture with the partnership with the legislature and really help move ideas into reality, right, as we look at the great creativity of our farmers, of our small and medium-sized agribusinesses, and, you know, the work that we get to do from producer all the way up to the Fortune 500 companies. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Schlick, thank you very much for your testimony and the others as well. So thank you very much. Questions from members. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. And so two quick questions. What are you guys doing around outreach to diverse communities and ensuring that, you know, we do have, and I think, you know, really looking forward to the food ingredients, you know, making sure that we are helping out folks who are providing, you know, ingredients or food that's, you know, maybe not in the mainstream market.
Who wants to tackle that one? Mr. Schlick?
Yeah. Hey. Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, thank you for the question. So we are working with stakeholders from all across, I'd say, all different sectors overall. We work with a lot of food entrepreneurs that are I would say, more diverse, right, in terms of what we're doing to try to reach out and have those conversations with HAFA, right, with the Latin American, development organization as well. Just we're always trying to reach out to see where we can be helpful and make sure that the resources are aware, that they're aware of our resources and that we can be an asset as we move those ideas forward. In terms of different activities as well, I know that some of our food scientists sit on different groups that are really focused on diversity and serving diverse food entrepreneurs, and I can follow up with more information specifically on different activities we're doing in that space.
Follow up, Representative Lee.
Quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think it'll be helpful, you know, just looking at the map that you have shared at the end of the presentation around the projects that you have. I think it'll be helpful if you could share, at least with me, you know, projects that have, you know, occurred in my district or not. I think that, you know, both myself and Representative Bajay, we have a lot of food entrepreneur that's in our district that are reaching out to see how could they get assistance from the state, and I think that this is a great opportunity for them to connect with you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Real quick specific question, speaking of bioindustries, one area that I think has a lot of promise for its sustainability, especially in construction projects really as a whole, is the hemp fiber industry. So this is kind of a broad question, but where are we at in the industrial production of that particular material? Looking forward, I mean, it's something we could maybe say like MDOT projects should use a certain amount for every project that they have. Is that something that is within the capabilities of that industry currently, or do you see in the near future that's something that could be possible?
Mr. Schlick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, thank you for the question. It's an area that we've had a lot of interest in terms of looking at the industrial hemp opportunities in the building sector. We were just at the Green Build conference that was in town, and we've done a lot of work looking at hempcrete. We just co-hosted a industrial hemp seminar in Breckenridge last week of really looking at these different opportunities. We've been talking with several companies that have been looking at Minnesota as well for investing in hemp processing. It's still very much in its infancy. in terms of, I think, what the needs are and how we move that forward. Our work is interesting as we look at the needs of moving this forward. A lot of our conversations around industrial hemp fiber ends up being around cotton, right, as the closest similarity in terms of some of the ways that we think about what's needed from industry guidance, specifications, right, just how do we get that to the point that we need to. And we're also having conversations with the Agricultural Research Service in terms of where do they see gaps and needs and how we could collaborate to help move that forward. So.
Follow up, Representative Smith.
Just a quick question, because it is, as you said, in its infancy. Do you know of, and we may follow up offline about this, other states where you see initiatives in this area that potentially Minnesota could improve on or copy in some way to help us get there?
Mr. Schlick?
Yeah, Chair Anderson, Representative Smith. I think we are having a lot of conversations with different entities. I feel like our neighbor to the west is doing a lot of work in industrial hemp in South Dakota. In terms of some of their activities in fiber processing specifically. We're working with groups out of Colorado, right, North Dakota. So we are creating those collaborations of just looking at how can we be more helpful. And then there is a National Industrial Hemp Association as well, right, and we are active with them and participating and then looking at, right, all the different aspects. But I'd love to follow up in terms of some how we can move that forward. I think we are a unique asset in having a decorticator specifically for industrial hemp of looking at pilot projects and how we can help move some of that forward, right, to fit the needs that you're mentioning.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Similar to Representative Lee, I sort of have some follow-ups on that. So it says you work with different collaborators, particularly to help some of the food entrepreneurs. Does that also extend to groups that are helping food entrepreneurs specifically kind of grow their business and scale up in commercial kitchens? So we have a group called Neon in my district. Have you worked with them before, groups like them?
Mr. Schlick?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abaje, excuse me if I
no, that's right.
Get that correctly. Yes, our food business development director has been in touch with Neon, right, and had conversations. And, yeah, we're always looking for those collaborations where we could be helpful as an asset and as a resource. I think Neon's doing great work from what I've seen in terms of the commercial kitchen and looking forward. And just several groups that we've seen come together, we see a good coalition around this scale-up of food manufacturing that's just needed, that a lot of groups want to tackle. And all right, coming together to do that collaboratively is just a really good opportunity.
Quick follow-up.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then is the only, based on the map that you gave here, the only place that's listed in the metro area is University of Minnesota, which is great, but are there other places where people can go to in addition to University of Minnesota in the metro area?
Mr. Schlick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we have an office at the University of Minnesota, but our staff are located to help anybody around the metro area, and more broadly around the state as well. So we do have virtual office hours, right, that we host as well online, and then our team is always available for one-on-ones to meet with anybody anywhere around the metro area as well or around the state to have conversations. So really, it's just to start the process. We can meet at the U of M or we can meet anywhere. We are servicing much more broadly than just at the U of M.
Great.
Yeah, and we'd be happy to send follow-up as well with a list of clients we've had in your district.
Yes, that'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here, guys. I'm curious. I noticed one slide talked about soy meal fertilizer. You didn't touch on it, but I'm curious if you've explored volumes and what kind of knowing the large amount of co-products that would come from sustainable aviation fuel. I'm curious what kind of research have you done there and what kind of volumes of fertilizer that market is.
Mr. Schlick.
Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson, Representative Burkle. So I know that we've looked at the potential volume there. I don't recall it off the top of my head, but we were looking at ornamental horticulture, lawns, getting into egg retailers in terms of just what were some of those higher value markets. We've done some tests at universities as well as municipal parks, right? So we just started thinking about where does it best fit and then working backwards on the demand. But I'll follow up with you on some of the initial numbers that we had. And it really is, for us, is just showing proof of concept right now that it works and, right, that we are exceeding the base, right, or doing as good as the base that they're using today with a different type of product.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Savory or Director Schlitt could help with this, but I didn't see the budget in the presentation. So how much, what was last year's budget, and maybe a trend line over the last 10 years for the budget? And then also, what do you have for reserves in terms of your budget?
Mr. Savory, if you can look it up quickly.
Chair and members, the FY24-25 total appropriations were $10.7 million, and the base for FY24-27, the dynamic of the committee will be budgeting for is $8,686,000. Details of FY20-29 is the exact same number.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's a reduction after the one-time money. Did you, Mr. Chair, Director Schlitt, do you receive any federal money that is on hold or at risk?
Yeah, Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, thank you for the question. Right, our base funding today is about 4.343 per year, right, as was mentioned. Our fiscal year 24 budget, we had roughly $700,000 in federal funding that we received that we leveraged to run projects forward. We've looked overall. We have about 5 federal projects going on today. Some of them are small. Some of them are a little bit larger. We are not aware of any right issues today in terms of concerns around funding or payment.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a final question. So are the employees a part of the collective bargaining unit? So you'd have to provide for the annual or the biannual increases. You're going to need that salary adjustment even though the tails are flat. Is that correct?
Mr. Schlecht?
And Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, we are not part of the collective bargaining unit. We're a standalone nonprofit, 501c3. So we do not receive automatic cost of living adjustments. We come back to the committees right when we need a cost of living adjustment to just look at how do we maintain our capabilities, right, and staffing needs as well as our rising costs that we incur as an organization.
Representative Hansen, a follow-up.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence on this. So that left another question. But, you know, you're a mature organization. It's been about 40 years. Has there ever been, like, an independent third-party assessment on outcomes and effectiveness? I know previously, like, the University of Minnesota has done work on, like, the turf industry and what their ripple effect has been. Have you ever had an outside economic analysis on
Mr. Schlecht,
your impact?
Excuse me.
Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen. Yes, we had an economic contribution study completed by the U of M. I believe it was in 2019 was the last time that we had that completed, where they looked at direct, indirect, and induced impacts that the organization is having. We are probably due to do one of those again here in the short term, especially as we look at our fiscal year 26 goals of $500 million. In terms of ensuring, right, or showing, best illustrating that we're meeting those goals and using the taxpayer dollars prudently.
Mr. Chair, if I may add.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I just want to add a board perspective on this because, yes, we have out external assessments, but I think what's most important is the level of rigor that the organization and the staff uses in evaluating each and every project and prioritizing, thinking of the outcome and the equity on how we work across such a diverse set of projects that we can serve. I've worked in industry for over 30 years, and the processes and the dedication of the staff is second to none. And the board reviews the priorities, both on an annual budget level and in every board meeting, and we're purview on how the dollars are being spent and how the priorities are being focused. And we have revamped all that strategic focus over the last 3 years as well.
Thanks, Mr. Tripodi. See, no further questions. I just have one final comment. I was at a meeting this morning of the Rural Finance Authority, and a lot of bankers in for the meeting. And one of them commented that the work he's done so far, looking ahead and even looking back, he has seen no cash flows so far that show a positive return for corn and soybeans for the coming year. So we talk about value added. I think it's an extremely important aspect that we can add to the crops that farmers produce to add that value a little bit more back into the farmers' hands, because it's going to be tight the next year or so in the production agriculture. So thank you for your presentation very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Office of Broadband Development. Deed folks, welcome to the meeting today. Shifting gears a bit. Thanks for being here, and tell us the good story of what you're doing with your office. And it is a good story. We hear from other states that Minnesota is looked at as a model. So thanks for your work, and begin your testimony. Identify yourself and continue.
Well, good afternoon, committee. Thank you, Chair Anderson and members. My name is Bree Mackey, and I serve as the Executive Director at the Office of Broadband Development at DEED. I'm also joined by Nathan Ratner on our government's relations team to keep me in check. So with that, we will start the presentation, and I'm really here to just give you an overview on the work that we have done over the past year and what we're continuing to do with the office. So as a reminder, this is our broadband policy framework, and I just like to remind everyone that these are sort of the pillars of the work that we do at the office. We do have statutory goals that were created by the legislature, our broadband office, and then the governor's task force on broadband, which we served as administrative support to. The tools that the legislature has given us through the border-to-border grant program, the low population, and the line extension programs. And then also data. So we have been doing robust mapping in Minnesota since 2008 around broadband, and that continues within our office as well. And the legislature always looks to provide additional funds to make sure that those mappings are correct and up to date. So here is our team. A few years ago when I took on this role, we were very small but mighty, and we continue to be very small with the dollar amounts that we are responsible for deploying across the state. Again, we were established in 2013 by the legislature, and through the years, we have the border-to-border grant program, and I'm going to touch on each of these separately, but the low population program, line extension, and then more recently through IIJA, the BEAD, Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, as well as the Digital Equity Act. So before we get into the program specifically, it is always important to just highlight and show some milestones so that you can see the work we've done. So last year we did celebrate 10 years of the Office of Broadband Development. We also held 4 sessions, and these were what we called Navigating Plus. And we know that broadband has a lot of other agencies we partner with. There's a lot of permitting, land use, and state systems, as well as tribal partners. So we really wanted to collaborate with those other sister agencies and provide information to our internet service providers and broadband partners. And then on this page also, I'm just going to highlight that we did carry out 81 site visits for our state infrastructure grant. So every grant that we close out, we are going out there, we're testing speeds, working with their mapping vendor, and making sure that all the locations that they had applied to serve are served. And if they are not, we make those adjustments on their final payments. Additionally, just a couple things to highlight here as well is, as I mentioned, we do provide administrative support to the governor's task force on broadband. They are independent of our office and have their own objectives, but we do help support them. A couple BEAD milestones, so Volume 1 and Volume 2 were both approved by NTIA over the last year, as well as our Digital Opportunity Plan and Capacity Grant Program were approved. And then I'm going to go to the next slide. So where are we still at in Minnesota? What are our unmet needs? Each year we do update our maps twice a year. You can find this online. I know it is very small in print. But numbers from December of 2024, there are still 143,000 households or businesses that do not have access to 25x3. That is our 2022 goal. And then 189,000 without the access of 100x20. Now, it might might get a little confusing when we start talking about BEAD eligible, so the federal eligibility numbers, because, and as I noted there, there are approximately 81,000 homes and businesses that are eligible under the BEAD definition of reliable broadband. So that's a little bit confusing. Hopefully by the end of the presentation, it will be a little bit more clear. I also just want to point out you can look at the numbers from November 2023 and see that about 20,000 more homes and businesses were served. I do want to point out that is a combination of state dollars, local investments by our internet service providers, and other federal programs that invest in broadband across the state. One of the things that we were also very curious and eager to learn more about was the dollars that we received from BEAD. We did not feel that $652 million would be enough dollars to get to all of the homes and businesses, as I defined a little bit ago, with those dollars based on how Minnesota has deployed broadband over the years. So we did an RFP, and the purpose was, A, to determine the amount of funding to serve under BEAD, what that looks like, and then also understand what it would cost overall if we went 100% fiber line. And we did contract with a company called CTC Technology and Energy, not to be confused with CTC, one of our good broadband providers in Minnesota. So the goals of this RFP was, A, what does universal coverage look like? Funding optimism, so how do we make our funds go as far as we can with the technologies we have available, and then the technology feasibility. So again, looking at the technologies, understanding the dollars we have, and maximizing them. What we found through this process was if we were going to serve 100%, and at that time this was before we had all of the final locations, so the 193, just use that as a number, but it was about $2 billion to do fiber everywhere based on those numbers. If we were going to do BEAD-only eligible locations, so not Minnesota, the first numbers I showed you, it would cost us about $99 million to do fiber in just those 81,000 locations under BEAD. So we don't have that kind of dollars. So with box number three, it shows that we will get to about 90,000 locations, again, before we had our final locations. So I know I said 81,000, but basically 10% of the eligible locations in BEAD will have some sort of alternative technology. So we will go as far as we can, but about that 10%, little under, will receive that. Hopefully this will start getting a little clearer. I know that's a lot of numbers I'm throwing at you, but just let's take a moment and reflect on the border-to-border grant program and low population program. So as a reminder, border-to-border, the traditional program that was originally set up, allows for up to 50% cost share on eligible locations. The low population density program is up to 75% of eligible costs. And I think it's really important to understand that there's a business case that has to be made for our internet service providers to do this work, and this is where the public-private partnership comes in. With the low population density, again, we realize this is the most difficult, hardest places to serve, otherwise they would have been served. Both are competitive grant programs through the internet service providers applying, and no grants can be more than $10 million. Businesses and residents don't have a formal role in this particular program, but they can do letters of support, and certainly we see counties and partnerships across the state working with internet service providers to maximize relationships. ISPs in this these two programs have 2.5 years to complete the build, and they must offer speeds of 100 by 20 at completion, and those need to be scalable. Again, these are grant reimbursement programs, and as I mentioned earlier, every grant is site monitored. We go out in the field, we do speed tests, and we map the locations as well. In the next slide, I just want to give you an overview overall of all of the broadband grant rounds that we have. So we've had 10, and through that, it's you can see the numbers. And this also includes the low population. So I did break them up in the chart if you're interested in how much has gone in each of those places. But overall, the state has invested in over $400 million. With that, it's important to note that this is something that our internet service providers also invest local dollars in, and that has been over $503 million in local investment. And to date, 119,000 plus have been served. And then under, as of December 2024, you can see where each of our grant rounds are currently at. And I just also want to point out that last year at the legislature, you all approved a $5 million move, and we did do that, move $5 million into low population out of the traditional border-to-border because we had some really solid applications within that program, and so really appreciate having that flexibility based on the applications that we received. So the final program under the state is the line extension program, and in 2022, with capital projects dollars, $15 million was allocated to this program. This program, actually, businesses and residents do have a key role. They self-register online, or they can give a call or fill out paperwork, and they register their home or location for the program. This is a reverse auction, and the max on this is $25,000 per location. This is really a program not like border to border, but really grants are to extend existing broadband infrastructure from that infrastructure to an unserved location. So a line extension is a very visual, properly named. All right, and you can probably read the rest, but it is a one-year build. So our internet service providers have a year to get that extension to homes. And just wanted, again, to provide you a little overview of the program as a whole. Since 2002, we have had three rounds of line extension approved bids. Overall, we've had over 5,700 homes and businesses register, self-register. And with these three location or rounds awarded, about 2,200 overall have been approved. This is a very oversight-intensive program, I will just note, because we verify every location of whether they may be getting served under another enforceable commitment, whether they already have service by a provider, and perhaps the location is unaware of the provider that they could go through with reliable broadband, again, just verifying that they are eligible for the line extension program. So we do very much due diligence on this program.
Ms. Mackey, quick question. If somebody currently would have a satellite connection to the internet, could they qualify for this line extension to get the hardwire installation?
Thank you for the question, Chairman. Yes, so as of right now, under what we define in the state as reliable broadband, low orbiting satellite is not considered that, so they could apply for the line extension program. All right, so moving on from our state-funded dollars programs to IIJA and the federal funds, there are two programs, as I mentioned, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. That is the $652 million that is to go into infrastructure across the state. When the allocation was made to the state, it was based on FCC maps, where there was about 89,000 locations eligible for BEAD. Again, I will talk about the difference with the 81,000 now. There's 4 years once the grant awards are approved that internet service providers would need to build out. And then the second program is the Digital Equity Act funding, and Minnesota's first round of allocation for that is $12 million. This estimated timeline is specific to BEAD itself. As you can see, this started in 2022 when the notice of funding opportunity was made available to states. states had to commit to that by June. And where we are right now is our final proposal with Volume 1 and Volume 2 were approved in October last year. From that date, we have 365 days to show that we can get to all the unserved and then underserved locations across the state. Once NTIA approves that plan, then we can get to work in contracting with our internet service providers. Right now, actually, I'll go over that in another slide. So moving to the next slide, again, based on this program and the rules under NTIA or the National Telecommunications Information Administration under Department of Commerce, for those of you, I'm spewing out acronyms and I apologize. We have to hit priority one first, and that's any unserved locations across the state, so not having 25 by 3. Once we can show those locations that are going to be served, we can then move on to the underserved locations. And if we have any dollars left, we can then use priority 3 and get to community anchor institutions. So the timeline, again, a little bit more in detail. I'm going to jump way to January 2025 in the dark blue. NTIA did approve our final list of locations. So we had to go through what was called a challenge process in order to get to that point. We submitted those locations. NTIA has now approved those locations as our final list. We are currently in our pre-qualification period. So we kept moving as we were waiting for that, created a portal where internet service providers could go in and pre-qualify, put their information in, and they have until February 27th to do that. That does not tie them to have to apply, but they need to apply in pre-qualifications in order to then apply in the subgrantee selection. It also gives us an opportunity to see what providers are interested and maybe where gaps are going to be across the state. We're hoping to launch our first subgrantee selection round between March and April. We're planning on doing 3 subgrantee selection rounds. The first one will be focused on fiber only, and our providers can choose their project locations. The second round, we as the office have the authority to select project locations, and other technologies can then apply in round 2 and 3. And you can see that the timeline's broken out with those 2 rounds. And by October 3rd, we have to submit that plan to NTIA. So not to be confused with our challenge process in border to border, with BEAD, we also had to do a challenge process with the locations. As I mentioned, our dollars were based on the FCC maps. We want to make sure that we are only funding locations that do not already have funding from other sources, have not been built by private dollars, and also are not hay bales in the middle of the field. So we wanted to make sure those were accurate maps because we want to maximize our dollars. What we did learn was in Minnesota, we have over 2 million locations that are currently served or funded in some capacity. Over 40,000 are unserved, and then 48,000 are underserved and unserved. So that's where the 81,000 locations comes into play, the 89,000 locations. So that's the final list. We also know that we're going to be continuing to do duplication as we go through. So again, if there's a reconnect fund that picks up a location, we will continue to try to do that. But this is the basis. And in order for us to take those locations off, we do have to provide some pretty significant information to our federal partner stating that they have service. All right, so that was a lot, but one more program I just want to update you on, and that is the Digital Equity Act. There were 3 components of the Digital Equity Act: planning grants, capacity grants, and competitive grants. The planning grants all states received in order to create a digital equity plan across the state. We did our digital opportunity plan over the last year, really focused on it being Minnesota-driven. We had that plan approved. the capacity grants are what states get, and then there were some competitive grants that other organizations who could apply could do so. Minnesota did receive two that applied, the Hmong American Partnerships and the Minnesota State College and University Systems both received funding. So those are direct from NTIA. We are not involved except for to be partners with them. So how we approached this work was we went out into communities across the state. We had self-directed community digital connection committees, and all of those committees created information, provided us information, and from that approach, we also had listening sessions, drafted a plan, went back to them, had them review the plan, and really tried to create a plan that was Minnesota's plan, not Office of Broadband's plan, not NTIA's plan, but Minnesota-driven. So the capacity grants that we will be administering is the $12 million. Those were non-competitive dollars that each state received based on a formula. Our application for those dollars was approved in December, and now we are working on preparing RFPs and grant contracts for NTIA to approve. And we will be working with many populations across the state to deploy those dollars. What is in the plan? Again, the goal of digital opportunity or equity for us is really the goal is adoption, and how do we make sure that all people understand the need to adopt the use of the internet, and that is to connect people with people, people with information, and people with resources. What future opportunities within this is, again, we're collaborating with cities, counties, tribes, area agencies on aging, veterans home, community action agencies, public libraries, independent living centers, and regional development commissions to do non-competitive grants. So making sure that everybody has an opportunity for those dollars to do work across the state. We're also hoping to create a networking opportunity for digital opportunity leaders to combine their local knowledge and resources with statewide. And then we will also have some competitive opportunities as well with that $12 million. So with that, here's the contact information. Thank you and this Ag Committee and Policy Committee for the support that you've given the Office of Broadband and the connections to not only all parts of Minnesota. We really appreciate that. The last little plug I'll say is we do a biweekly email blast. A lot of information is in that, and if I can help connect you to that as well, I'm happy to do so. But with that, I'm happy to stand for any questions you may have.
Questions from members? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier in the slide or in the presentation, you talked about addressing Minnesota's unmet needs and that there are state, local and federal funding. So how much of that is just in dollars federal funding, and what percentage of the pie is that?
Ms. Mackey, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and Representative, for the question. So we did receive capital projects dollars of $130 million that the legislature directed into broadband. And so that technically would come from the Treasury, so that's $130 million. And then the B dollars is $652 million, and the capacity grant dollars, or the digital equity grant dollars was the $12 million. So I would say if we could plop back to, sorry, there's a page, there was a breakdown of the low density. So if you would take this page, setting aside BEAD dollars, setting aside digital equity dollars, the $40 million, subtract the $130 million in capital projects, and that would be the difference of 270 of state dollar resources that have been allocated through general funds.
Representative Frederick.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Then a follow-up question would be, are we seeing anything at the federal level that may impact our ability to continue expanding into what is essentially greater Minnesota?
Ms. Mackey?
Thank you, Chair Anderson and Representative, for the question. So certainly we are monitoring what is happening at the federal level. When the executive order came down, we were concerned about our Treasury dollars those are dollars that the capital projects dollars that we already have allocated out, and ultimately any freezes would impact our internet service providers getting reimbursed. That was lifted very quickly the next day, as well as BEAD. So until we are told otherwise, at this point, Minnesota stands committed to doing the work that we have said we are going to do. And so we are hopeful that we are not impacted in the long term.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. And so if you could just help me understand this a little bit more with the definitions and whatnot. I've been hearing a lot from my constituents where, you know, being in Minneapolis, it seems like we're not having high-speed connections throughout, you know, certain parts of the city of Minneapolis. And so under the current definitions right now, is Minneapolis not considered under any of the speed that the FCC has for any of these programs, or where do we currently sit?
Ms. Mackey?
Thank you, Chair Anderson and Representative Lee. So that is a very challenging question. So our job at the Office of Broadband is to make sure everybody has one good provider. In the metro area, oftentimes there are locations, and we are working with some of our metro counties where there is going to be eligibility, and we, frankly, under BEAD, will have to serve them if they are truly unserved. However, there is a difference, and I know, especially in multi-unit dwellings, that what is reported isn't necessarily what folks are receiving. And so that is a little bit of a difference between what we can support and help with versus making sure, you know, we ask people to report to the FCC all the time. We aren't the regulatory agency on that. So it's a really tough question, and we certainly empathize and get it quite frequently, but our hands are a little tied on just competitive markets and what providers are offering and what people receive.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I see in your presentation, I think for the digital equity program, we have it approved from the feds in December 2024. And then when I look at the presentation, I didn't really see a lot of information about the programs. And so can you share what's actually been approved? And the question that I ask, would that be considered part of digital equity? And if not, then can you explain to me what is the state's definition of what digital equity is then?
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, and for the additional question, Representative Lee. This is a hard question because we are developing a plan with our capacity grants, but at the end of the day, our federal partner approves it. So within the parameter of what is allowed, we are looking at what is best for the state. There are also covered populations that we need to adhere to, and those include aging, veterans, those in rural community, low income, so taking those all into consideration. As we are developing these programs, we really wanted to make sure there was an opportunity to have non-competitive grants because we know a lot of communities don't have the resources to even apply for grant dollars versus expend them, whether you're in a small rural county or in a metro area. So we are still working on that and trying to frame it in the guidelines that NTIA has given us. I pointed out, you know, some of the things we're focused on is the Navigator component is making sure people have access, as well as, just some of the designated things that were in our digital opportunity. How do we connect people to people? Well, they need devices. So there's going to be competitive grants, too, that folks can apply for, and if that means they need to apply for additional laptops for their senior center, then that would be an eligible thing that we would consider in those competitive grants, as well as the non. So it's still evolving, and we're still working on it, but I will just say there's a lot of planning for the plans in these programs to ensure that we are meeting the NOFO requirements of our federal partners and what's in the best interest of Minnesota as well.
Follow up, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I think it would be great if you could follow up with members of the committee with regards to the plan that was approved by the federal government, and also what are the other opportunities for us to engage with the office to make sure that, you know, we are addressing some of the digital equity concerns that, you know, right now may not be considered as part of the program that was included, but, you know, for constituents in my area that, you know, do face the difficulty of being able to access, you know, the internet or to connect for to information or to even just do work at home, you know, homework or whatnot for our students. And so really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative Lee. Ms. Mackey, I had a quick question before we move on. You've been dealing with the state program for 10 years now, the program is doing very well. And then you've had this federal program given to your office or whatever you want to say. And I'm sure it's taken a lot of your time and your staff time. Are there any federal dollars you can tap into for your admin costs, or how does that work with you working on both those programs?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Chair Anderson. So with the $652 million, when we started this process, states were allowed to have access to $5 million for those planning. So the $5 million is what we have and have been using to staff our team, develop a grants management system with all of the requirements, get the information out there, do the challenge process, all those things that we have been doing for the past 3 years. We also, because of the state's anti-deficiency clause, when we did our budget, we did ask for access of all those dollars up front. Now, we don't have them in the bank account, but we have access to them to get reimbursed. And so with the budget there, we did allocate funding. We can allocate funding for the administrative additional burdens that or opportunities that we have. Sorry. We also are partnering with other agencies as well. We know, for those of you who are not aware, there is a lot of permitting requirements and land use requirements to do broadband. So having really good conversations with SHPO office, OSA, DNR, MnDOT to make sure they are all staffed up as well. I went through the numbers of state dollars, and now all at once we're going to get $652 million to deploy broadband, and they need those staffing, and we need those partnerships as well. So there are dollars that we can tap into, but we're trying to be very fiscally responsible and frugal, because every dollar we have to take from admin is dollars that are going to take away from infrastructure, and that will have us to look a little bit more closely on more alternative technology locations.
Okay. We've heard from some providers that they're concerned about the regulations with the federal program. I heard one that if a provider has a loan with his bank and he would have to subordinate that loan to the government to qualify for the BEAD program, can you characterize in general the acceptance by providers of these federal programs?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. That's a really excellent question. One thing I will just say that Minnesota has a strong foundation of working with all of the associations. It's pretty remarkable that all the types of providers can sit in the same room and advocate with each other. That doesn't happen in other states, or has, because of the long history there. We know that there are concerns with this program. You as a legislature directed us to build the BEAD program as closely as we could to border to border. We did our very best to do so. However, there are requirements that NTIA have that sound like they still feel burdensome. I am working very closely with NTIA and the administration to look at ways that we can make it more attractive for our providers to participate. I've encouraged them all to at least do the pre-qualification, and we'll continue to advocate for changes that will make it more accessible for them to participate with a business model. Also encouraging them to look at waivers or ask in their applications, because at the end of the day, every location has to be served. And so I would hate for a provider to stay out because I'm going to have to put somebody there. And we have really great small telcos, rural electric cooperatives, cable providers across the state that I'm hopeful will participate. But I do know there are still some challenges that they feel with the program, but advocating as hard as I can.
Thank you. See, no further questions from members of either side. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Very thorough. And our third item on today's agenda, the Center for Rural Policy and Development.
Mark just had a presentation.
Pardon? Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you need technical help, Mark is coming to the rescue there.
Thank you. Well,
again, the Center for Rural Policy Development, identify yourselves for the record and proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman and members. My name is Marnie Werner, and I'm the Vice President of Research at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. And we would like to thank you today for inviting us to discuss our research on the state of rural Minnesota and additional pressing topics affecting Minnesotans. As many of you know, the Center for Rural Policy and Development is a nonprofit research organization created by the state legislature to partner with you and other Minnesota policymakers by producing non-biased research on topics critical to our state. We greatly enjoy working with you, and we want to thank you for your ongoing support. So the State of Rural is a report we produce annually and that we are happy to share with you today. With that, Mr. Chair, when we have figured out the technical issues, I will turn it over to our senior researcher, Kelly Ash. But in the meantime, I'd be happy to entertain any questions before the presentation.
That's what we call filling time here. So any questions? You're centered out of Mankato, correct?
Right. Well, we actually, our mailbox is in Mankato, but we all work out of our homes. So I'm located in Mankato. Kelly lives in New London, and our CEO, Julie Tesh, lives on her family farm outside of Waldorf in south central Minnesota.
Okay. Very good. You all have members. You have the fairly thick packet in your packets from the center, and we are racing quickly to try to get it online here.
And I will Mr. Chair, I'll guide you through a paper if that works.
All right. Looks as though we may have to do it the old-fashioned way here.
Okay.
So identify yourself, sir, and proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize about this. I'm a little new to this. I should have brought my right computer, but so we're going to talk a little bit about three different things today.
Give me your name.
Oh, yes. My name is Kelly Ash. I'm the senior researcher at the Center for Rural Policy and Development.
And we have about 35 minutes.
Okay, great.
Remaining. Okay.
Thank you. I'm first going to talk about the state of rural, which, as Marnie was talking about, it's an annual report we do where we just track trends in various demographic and economic variables across rural Minnesota. The three we're going to talk about today, or I should say two, is population, migration, as well as job vacancies. There's a lot of other things in that report. You feel free to go online and read up on some of those other types of variables. But these three things we're going to highlight today because they kind of underlie a lot of different challenges that rural Minnesota is facing regarding its demographics and how that relates to job vacancies across rural Minnesota. Slide number four, you'll see kind of like that data lag one. What that is looking at is, just keep in mind, the data you're looking at isn't for this year. It's actually 2023 data. It's collected. It's kind of looked at over 2024. Then it's released, and that's why every beginning of every year we release the report, but it's actually about two-year data lag. So 2023, just getting out of the impacts of the pandemic, and so now we can kind of start looking at this decade of 2020 a little bit more in terms of trends, not just a blip due to the pandemic. Slide number five there, just defining rural, just real quickly, there's a lot of different ways that we can define rural. In this particular presentation, I'm going to be using this quite a bit, which is kind of four different categories. A county can be entirely rural, town-rural mix, urban-town-rural mix, or entirely urban. All that means is, yes, it's tied to population, but it's also tied to the percentage of the workforce that may travel to an adjacent county that might be, let's say, more urban. It ties that in as well. So there might be a county such as Traverse County, which would be pretty rural, but it travels to Morris, Minnesota, and thus might have more of a rural town mix to it.
Okay.
Your password again.
Oh. Pardon?
Does he need a mask?
And I'll keep going here.
Okay.
Password. Slide number 7 here. So we're going to start looking at some population changes. I know everybody always gets pretty intrigued about where's population at for rural areas versus metropolitan areas. It's important to keep in mind there's two different components when we're looking at population change. There is natural change, which so we're talking about births and deaths. That's going to change population as well as migration change. So who's coming in versus who's coming out. Those are the two components. Let's first take a look at the natural change. And this is kind of a big deal across rural Minnesota. Thank you. No, this should be just fine. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. This is my fault. So, all right. So, one thing that's impacting rural areas is, as many of you probably know, is that we have an older population in our rural counties. And this is kind of playing out in very different ways. And actually, the entire state in general. We're an older state. We're in the Frost Belt. Migration isn't as big of a deal as natural change is in Minnesota. But how that trickles down to rural versus metro is quite a bit different. So if we look at our entirely rural county group, so the map on the left are the counties that we aggregated together for this chart on the right. Chart on the right, the blue line is the number of births happening in those counties. The red line is the number of deaths. The thing that we're tracking and a thing we're kind of nervous about and the thing that we're probably going to see over the next 20 to 25 years is the increasing amount of deaths. And you can see there, I kind of put a little line there saying, look at that gap. That gap is really starting to increase to the point where we're having significantly more deaths than births in our entirely rural counties, thus having a negative impact on our population change. The next chart looks at town-rural county group. And you can see the shaded counties that are considered town-rural. They actually, for a long time, had been having more births than deaths, up until right around the pandemic when that crossed over. And now these counties, at an aggregate level, are having more deaths than births, thus having a negative impact on their population change. This next chart looks at urban-town-rural county group. Aggregated together, you could see significantly more births than deaths for a long time, up until just recently, when now we are seeing those kind of slammed together and essentially balancing each other out. So we're having just as many deaths as births in these counties now. And this is our entirely urban county group. And it's important to note that we have entirely urban counties in greater Minnesota, Blue Earth County being one, Clay County the other, down by Rochester, Olmsted, some of those. And you could see significantly more births than deaths for a long time. But even that is starting to close a little bit. And it's all due to just this aging demographic that we have in Minnesota. This is all just kind of setting ourselves up for, as a state, an uphill battle versus natural change, the natural demographic changes that we're seeing in our state. In metropolitan areas, they have so many more births than deaths that they can weather that a little bit better. Our most rural areas cannot. They're going to be experiencing more deaths than births. So that means for population change, we have to depend on migration changes in order to have any sort of positive influence on overall total population. So if we look at our entirely rural county group, and I should mention these are trend lines. These are smooth trend lines. So if you look at the actual raw data, it's quite a bit more jagged. But this is the statistical use of smooth lines. And looking at the trends, what's kind of interesting is you see from 2000 to about 2010, there was a declining net increasing net out migration in domestic individuals throughout entirely rural counties. But that started to turn around, and it was right around 2017 in particular when we really started to see some significant changes in domestic migration. Quite a bit more in our entirely rural counties to the point where they were actually having a net in migration at an aggregate level. Town-rural county group, a very similar trend line. We're seeing net out migration domestically. That has turned around, and up until about 2023, now they're starting to see a positive net in migration, which is great. And then they have a pretty robust international in migration as well. That's that purple line on the chart. And that's an important component of all of this as well in population change. Urban Town Rural County Group, again, very similar, even though they've done quite a bit better and did experience quite a bit net domestic in-migration during the early 2000s, they were seeing a pretty steep decline there to the point where they were seeing and experiencing net out-migration by 2010. But that has also turned around beginning around 2015, 2016 is when we started to see those trends change quite a bit. Now, I broke up the entirely urban group into entirely urban Greater Minnesota, entirely urban suburban, and entirely urban Hennepin and Ramsey. So I'm going to show you those three charts next. This first one is looking at those counties that are entirely urban but are outside of the seven county metro. And you can see it's a very similar story, kind of like they were seeing those net in-migrations, kind of plummeted there a little bit. But has recovered and is pretty stable now to the point where they're seeing a net positive in-migration. If we look at those entirely urban counties that are in the seven county metro, very similar. They've actually never dipped below having a net out-migration. They've always had a net in-migration that's fluctuated a little bit, but that has increased. And the biggest reason I put these apart is because Hennepin and Ramsey are experiencing a very different kind of roller coaster of a migration trend. And some people might be surprised. I think we always think, particularly Hennepin and Ramsey, have always just experienced that's where everybody is moving to. But that actually hasn't been the case since the early 2000s. They've struggled with domestic in-migration. Their international in-migration has always been very, very solid and robust. But their domestic in-migration has been a little bit more on a roller coaster and really took a big hit during the pandemic. It's important to pause here that it can be easy to see in-migration and out-migration as people coming and going. So if you see a net out-migration, you might think, oh, everybody's leaving. It could be, and it's hard to get at this data, but there are research that shows that it's not necessarily a bunch of people left, but that far less people moved in than in previous years, which can really then impact that ability to keep migration net changes. So what does that mean? So we sum these things together to figure out what are the population changes across Minnesota. And for the past couple, for this decade, it's looking pretty positive. So last decade, we had 46 counties that had a lower population in 2019 than they did in 2010. By 2020, 2023, we now have, there's 46 counties. Now there's only 21 counties that have less population in 2023 than they do in 2020. That's a pretty good turnaround for a lot of rural Minnesota. This means that right now the positive migration trends that they're seeing are counteracting the natural change where there's more deaths than births throughout rural Minnesota. Can that last? I think that's the big question we're all trying to figure out. We won't know for a few more years how those trends will kind of even out after the pandemic here. The last thing I'll say before we kind of talk about a couple topics is looking at job vacancies. This is probably a thing that you hear quite a bit as representing your constituents, probably from your employers. Been a lot harder to find people to take their jobs. And the data will surely back them up. This is a job vacancy survey conducted by Deed here in Minnesota. And you can see job vacancy rates hovering between 4.5% and 6.5%. We consider a healthy job vacancy rate to be about 3% to 4.5%. That means you have a number of jobs, which is great opportunity for the people there. But you also hope you have some sort of an applicant pool as a business owner. And you can see we have job vacancy rates high above that. The lowest is actually in the seven county metro at 4.6%, the highest in Northeast at 6.6%. That's a lot of job vacancies, but we are down from where we were in 2021 when we were darn near 10% job vacancy rate, which is absolutely, there's nothing like it. Like, I don't know any time in modern history we've ever seen anything like that. So the state of rural tends to be a bit of like what we call kind of a data dump. It's a lot of data, a lot of information, but it's really where this data intersects different issues and topics and policy that we find to be the most important. So we're going to present two here, just real quick, a quick high-level summary of research that we've conducted over the last year. This first one is looking at rural nursing facilities and in particular their capacity to provide for our elderly moving forward. Now, we're going to take a look at three things here, the demand for nursing beds, the declining capacity in nursing beds, and why there is so much decline. So we did some calculations to figure out what's going to be the demand moving forward for nursing beds. And you could see we're not near a peak yet in any of our kind of county groups. Even in our entirely rural areas, we're looking at probably 2037 when we peak for the need for demand for nursing beds. It's a little bit later as you become more urban. But again, everybody's going to be increasing their demand for nursing beds in the future over the next 20 years. The tough part is that we've actually seen some pretty significant declines in nursing beds across Minnesota. This is the state of Minnesota, and by 2024, it was the February data, licensing data I was using here, we've experienced a third of our nursing beds have disappeared since 2005. But not all things are equal. Our most rural areas have seen the most significant declines. It's about 42% decline in our entirely rural counties, 40% in our town rural mix, and then a little bit better, about a third, as you become more urban. So our rural areas have experienced the most significant declines in their nursing beds since 2005. So why are we experiencing this decline? There's really two kind of components to this that are essentially smashing together. The first one is this historical context that now that we have assisted living, we have home health care, home nursing care, we have a lot of different avenues in which elderly folks can get care and get taken care of that might be actually more appropriate. It wasn't, you know, in the 1980s and 70s, it was more or less you go to a nursing home and there was no other avenue for these folks to be taken care of. The market as well as policy changes have made it so that there's a lot more better avenues, better fits. And so part of this is that nursing homes, their capacity was going to decline no matter what because of this, because we're finding new avenues. However, it's gotten pretty severe. And so now we have the second factor of workforce shortages. We have, when we did interviews in the field with nursing home operators in rural areas, many, almost all of them said we are turning patients away because we do not have the workforce to take care of them. There are facilities that are closing their wings down, taking their beds and making them unlicensed because they've kind of given up hope that they're going to be able to fill up some of these nursing positions and care positions in order to be able to serve the needs of these patients. And so those are the two things that are coming and smashing together in particularly rural areas. We're going to be digging into this over the next few years, elderly care in rural Minnesota. So be on the lookout as we kind of continue to examine the issue a little bit further. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to pass it over to my colleague, Marnie, to present on mental health care access.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this is kind of a mashup of the of research that we've done over the last 4 years to give us an overview of mental health. And so up until about 2009, we saw that the mortality rate or the death rate for Americans in general was declining steadily. And then about 2009, the trend reversed, and that was largely due to what has now been called the diseases and deaths of despair. And those are specifically suicide, drug poisoning, including accidental overdose, and alcohol-related diseases. And you can see how, in particular, drug-induced deaths really took off in the late teens. The suicide rate since 2000 has been climbing steadily, especially among males. And the suicide rates, these are the trend lines for this, and they're labeled on here. You can see that the line that is rising fastest and is the highest right now is for the entirely rural group of counties in Minnesota. These are the counties that are the most rural, have the least dense population, while the entirely urban Twin Cities counties have the shallowest trend line. And so you can see how suicide rates really don't correlate, but they follow the population density. And then this is a regional look at it of rates of suicide by geography. This is 2018 to 2021, and you can see that in Northeast and Northwest Minnesota, they've been the highest and the lowest in the seven-county metro area. And then there are two groups in the state that really, there are several groups of concern that the Minnesota Department of Health watches, but there are two groups in particular in rural Minnesota, and those are farmers, which we know they have particularly unique issues that create a lot of stress for them, like volatility of markets, the threat of losing the farm and not carrying on a legacy creates quite a bit of stress. And then Native Americans. The suicide rate among Minnesota's Native American population, as you can see from the trend lines there, is noticeably higher than the national trend line for Native Americans. And then children's mental health, this is the most recent report that we did, came out last fall. Girls in particular, their mental health is deteriorating. This is a chart looking at reports of self-harm among children and adolescents. And as you can see that for girls aged 10 to 19, it seemed to start around 2009, 2010, and has really been trending upwards, and it got noticeably worse during the pandemic. And then emergency room visits, again, separated out between girls and boys. This is for kids aged 12 to 17, and this is between 2017 and 2013. This is the rate per 100,000 for four groups. They are general anxiety disorders, conduct disorders, depression, and suicidal ideation. And the ones that were noted as the primary reason for the visit to the hospital that day, and you can see how suicidal ideation in particular rose for girls in that time. Now, early intervention is key for everybody, but especially for children. And you see on the left, this is the beginning stage of early intervention, promotion, and even prevention. It helps to lessen the probability and severity of mental illness. And as it goes up in severity, you get the CTSS, Certified Therapeutic Services and Supports, I believe is what it stands for, school-linked mental health, crisis intervention. This is when a child just simply has a crisis, is unable to control themselves. Every county has a crisis phone number that parents can call, and hopefully the county has a mobile crisis team that can come out to de-escalate the situation. Intensive mental health services, these are the things like children's residential facilities and psychiatric residential treatment facilities. These are the things that have been talked about in the last several years about how we need more beds for these facilities. And we do need more beds for these. We are short. It's the same reason as for the nursing homes. There isn't enough workforce for these facilities to meet the rising demand. But also, if we can do something to lessen the demand earlier on, we would hopefully not have as much of a need for these beds later on. And then recovery and rehabilitation is a very important stage after a child has been in something like a residential treatment facility. It helps them adjust back to getting back into their normal life, going back to school and being at home after they've been away from home for a while. The workforce shortage is a big issue. You can see on this map that there's a pretty good concentration of workforce in the metro area. It's more spread out in the rest of the state. Probably almost more concerning is that 60% of mental health workers and providers are over the age of 55. So we're facing a lot of retirements coming up. And there is difficulty recruiting people into the field and even difficulty getting people to get licensed after they've gone through all the training and graduation. And there's difficulty in recruiting people to rural areas. And so all of the counselors, 82, or I shouldn't say all of them, but 82% of them are in metropolitan areas. So this would be the Twin Cities, Mankato, Rochester, Duluth, and that percentage gets much smaller. But also you can see in the professional to resident ratio, it goes from one mental health professional to 197 residents in the metropolitan area to one professional per 741 residents in isolated rural. So you can see how the access declines as you get into more rural areas. And one of the reasons for this workforce shortage that we uncovered in our research a couple of years ago is that higher ed doesn't have enough faculty. Because of accreditation regulations by the accreditation authorities, the universities and colleges, these programs have to have a certain faculty to student ratio. And if they go over that, if it's 1 to 12 and they go 1 to 14 or something like that, they will lose their accreditation. That means the university, if they want to take in more students, they need to have more faculty. And we found in the universities and colleges that we surveyed, they didn't have enough money to get more faculty, and they were actually turning away students from their programs because they didn't have enough faculty. And then the 988 mental health line, this was something that we also looked at. 988, we've had the suicide hotline for many, many years. It was changed to 988 in the middle of 2022 in an effort to make it more memorable for people, that they could remember it. And then it was also changed to the mental health line instead of just a suicide line. And so you can see on here, the 2018 through 2023, that last light blue bar there, usage of that line has gone up considerably since 2022, since that change. And so we talked a little in our research about what we can do right now. The long-term action is to try and work on something to improve the workforce, helping students afford their programs. One chart I didn't put in here shows that how even after graduation, when a student has to start repaying their student loans, they still have to go through 2 years of supervised training where they receive a fairly low pay because Medicare and Medicaid reimburse at a much lower rate for licensed, unlicensed providers. Or they may not reimburse at all for some of these programs. And insurance companies tend to follow Medicare and Medicaid's lead on these. And so these students are basically getting paid very low while they're trying to pay off their loans. And so that's why you start seeing some of this cherry picking among students, where they will go to a metro area where they can make more money, frankly. And then the other issue is that small independent rural clinics often can't afford to even host an intern because of that issue of not being reimbursed for that student's time. And so it's a little more complicated but as you can see, there is an issue with the way the whole system is set up. But then in the short term, it's going to take a while to get this workforce, get some of the solutions that are being tried for workforce through the pipeline. In the short term, we suggest that people learn more about mental health and mental illness. And therapists in schools and in primary care clinics are really showing promise, and they're bringing treatment closer to kids and families, especially in rural areas. And so with that, I thank you, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Warner, and also Mr. Ash. Questions from members? Again, thank you for coming. Very in-depth presentation. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is on, do you have breakdowns of demographic information in your surveys of crosstabs? And I'll use one example. So, for example, Amish people participate in the census, but they generally do not participate in any other surveys. So if you have a lot of families with 8, 9, 10, 12 kids that are in the census, but and there are several counties with very high Amish populations, but the other data doesn't necessarily get collected because they won't participate in those programs, or they may not even go to the hospital because they don't believe in insurance. So is there anything, have you looked at that data to see if there's things like that that may provide a clearer picture of the data for us as policymakers?
Mr. Ash, Ms. Warner.
Should I take that?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, it's a really good question. It's a tough one. So I think in a lot of rural areas, undercount, just talking about the census, and we could talk a little bit more about other data sources, but undercount is a pretty significant issue regarding just the decennial census, which is a mandatory thing that people have to fill out. The other big one that we use quite a bit and you see quite a bit that would be relevant is the American Community Survey, which is also distributed by the U.S. Census Bureau. That also should, that is mandatory. It's not voluntary. And so they should be filling that out. You know, there's always margin of errors associated with any of this, and so we kind of just trust the statisticians that they're hopefully covering for some of these things that may not work out well. But I will tell you that if it wasn't for the mandatory mandate on this stuff, we would not have any rural data in general, because as soon as you make that stuff voluntary, we won't get good response rate.
Thank you. Again, thanks to our testifiers today. A question from, Representative Agbaje. Mistia, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions, I hope they're quick questions. But on the slide when you were talking about why there's so much decline in the long-term care facilities, one of the things you mentioned is that financial and policy changes are allowing assisted living and other groups to take a bigger piece of the elderly care pie. Could you be more specific? Do you mean just like the programs in general that both the federal government and the state government have put forward, or do you mean like the actual companies and businesses that run these facilities? And just to kind of specify what you mean there.
Ms. Warner or Mr. Ash?
No. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Okay.
Representative Agbaje, thank you for the question. So probably one of the biggest fundamental or biggest policy changes that happened, I want to say it was in the 1980s, is a federal change on the elderly waiver and what it could pay for in terms of care. It used to be just used for nursing home care, but they opened that up to allow for payment in assisted living as well as home health care, really expanding that bucket. So I would say that was probably one of the biggest changes that occurred to really allow that market to flourish. And I don't want to say take people away from nursing care, but allow care to be taken in the appropriate location deemed fit. So,
follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I'll follow up with you more on that because I think I'd be interested to kind of better understand that space, because I think a lot of folks are having trouble in that space with the growing costs and, you know, just making sure that workers continue to stay there, that we're keeping track of who's actually managing these facilities and all that type of stuff. So I'll follow up on that. But my other question, though, was on in the suggested actions when it came to mental health. I'm wondering, are you guys also considering, I don't see it listed here, but specific interventions for your most specific, for your most vulnerable groups, like the farmers and Native Americans? Particularly, I know with different cultural groups, it's nice to have people who come from your same background who can help with whatever issues you might be facing. And so are there considerations for pipeline programs to ensure that, at least in this, you know, specific case of Native Americans in rural Minnesota, that more of them can be in line to be trained as mental health professionals to help out more members of the community?
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Warner?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, we are actually in the middle of a study right now looking at access to mental health care for people of color in rural Minnesota and looking at those barriers. One thing the center does is we do not do direct advocacy for particular programs or things like that. We provide the information so that those who do provide that advocacy has the reliable data and information that they need to then help them craft policies and programs. And so that is certainly something that we are looking at right now, and that we are confident that other organizations in greater Minnesota will be looking forward to, too. One of our biggest audiences is local government officials, and so, you know, counties and cities and where the social services come from. We'll all be looking forward to that, too. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No more questions. Again, thanks to our testifiers from the center. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.